It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Ahead of the elk hunt that opens next month and breeding season underway, we explore the management of herds in Wisconsin and challenges with the population. You can be part of the discussion by calling in with a question or sharing your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Josh Spiegel is a Hayward-based wildlife biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Josh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, good morning. Appreciate you guys reaching out and allowing me to come on.
Absolutely. Let's talk elk here, native to Wisconsin. Some backstory, though. They were wiped out by unregulated hunting and loss of habitat more than a century ago. How important are elk to our state's ecosystem?
Yeah, so really, it goes even beyond the state of Wisconsin here. So, back in the late 1800s, elk historically roamed most of eastern U.S. and Wisconsin being no differently. We had elk from basically north to south, east to west, and a large ungulate like that used our fairly open landscape, mostly in the southern two-thirds of the state and the timbers of the Northwoods, et cetera. You know, they were a staple of the landscape for a long period of time. And unfortunately, like you mentioned, unregulated hunting was the main reason we kind of lost them here from our landscape.
Okay, so they were a staple of the landscape. And then in the early 1900s, there was this failed reintroduction of elk that was attempted with animals from Yellowstone National Park. Where did the elk now, the elk that we have now in Wisconsin come from?
Yeah, so you hit it right on the head there. So in the 1910s, much of the eastern U.S. was getting elk from Yellowstone National Park, attempting to do the same thing Wisconsin did through reintroduction efforts using Rocky Mountain elk from out west. And one of the states, you mentioned Wisconsin's first failed attempt. One of the other states that received elk was Michigan, and Michigan received 7 elk about that same time frame as Wisconsin, and their herd took off from that 7. To fast forward a bunch of years, once their herd kind of established a strong number, they donated elk to the state of Wisconsin in 1995 after some legislative work was completed looking at feasibility to bring back a large ungulate. What the state of Wisconsin did was look at bringing back or improving the habitat for reintroduction efforts related to moose, woodland caribou, or elk. Unfortunately, moose and woodland caribou, there are a lot of different factors that played into that just didn't make it feasible. But elk are a strong generalist species that can live in a lot of different habitat types. So that kind of moved us forward. So we were able to get on with the state of Michigan, and we started our first modern day reintroduction effort as kind of an experiment in 1995 with 25 elk from Michigan.
Okay, so that brings us to today. There are now 2 herds of elk here in Wisconsin. Approximately how many elk does each herd include?
Yeah, you're right. So we've got 2 herds. One we call the northern herd. That would be up in my greater area. For anyone familiar with Clam Lake, Wisconsin, or parts of Ashland, Bayfield, Sawyer, Rusk, and Price counties, that herd is made up of about 355 animals at our high point estimate this year. And then we have a second herd that was started in 2015 and 16 in Jackson County, or just east of Black River Falls, Wisconsin. And that group has an estimate this year of about 160. So we're looking about 515 statewide as our what we call our post-calving estimate. So what we expect the most amount of animals this year to be.
We're talking about elk in Wisconsin with the state DNR wildlife biologist Josh Spiegel is here and fielding your questions along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Josh, it sounds like you have a pretty good feel for the estimate of elk. How does the DNR estimate herd size?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So Unlike most of the animals that we have in the state, you know, I'll take white-tailed deer, for example. There's so many on the landscape that you know, we have a pretty wide range for estimate. Elk, because they're localized in a couple different areas, they're a herd-associated animal. So usually if you see one or two, you're probably going to see a group of elk. So we have the ability to use a lot of different mechanism to do that. We do a lot of hands-on work. So in the winter time, we have the ability to put radio tracking collars on our elk. We have probably about 25 to maybe 30% of the population, 30% being about the top end, collared for monitoring and tracking reasons, and we get a ton of data from that. And then we also do other things like drone surveys, airplane surveys, field surveys where we go out and observe the elk. We get information from a lot of different partners or other people in the area that kind of share groups, you know, different landowners that see elk on a regular basis. So there's a ton of different factors that go into that. And at the end of the year, we draw all that information together and we put that in our population model, which projects some of our recruitment inputs, mortality factors, all that different things that go into population estimates for a given year.
I saw a snapshot Wisconsin trail camera photo of a group of elk in Sawyer County, and you could see the radio collars and their ID tag. So I would imagine that that is really helpful to figure out where they're going and kind of what they're doing.
100%. So Snapshot Wisconsin, not only for elk, but has provided a ton of information in wildlife management here in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, it's the use of a remote game camera that can be checked infrequently throughout the year. And that thing's collecting data 24/7. You know, the eyes are always on, per se. And from the same sense, we get a lot of private landowners. We do operate some other cameras for specific needs within the project that we establish at different points of the year. So the use of those remote cameras is amazing what we can do. And like you said, you get some pretty cool pictures out of it too.
So the number of elk in the state falls below the goal of 1,400. Why is 1,400 the target elk population?
Well, so that's not the statewide goal. 1,400 would be our goal for just the northern range. So when we wrote our original elk management plan, we're trying to stay about one elk per square mile. When we expanded that range, we decided that we're going to keep the elk population goal the same. So in 2012, we expanded our elk management zone in the north by 508 square miles, totaling a little better than 1,600 square miles. So now we're at a little less than one elk per square mile, and that was kind of based on suitable habitat within that elk range on the landscape. So there's a lot of stuff mixed in there, you know, lakes, et cetera, that kind of eat up space but don't count towards landscape habitat.
With the landscape habitat, is climate change affecting elk?
Yeah, so it's more affecting the landscape in which the elk live in. So we work very close with our foresters, kind of looking into how they're planning on managing the forest moving forward through climate change, et cetera. But elk are an extremely hardy animal on both sides of those equations. So there's elk found in portions of Mexico, there's elk found in Canada, East Coast, West Coast. You know, they're very adaptive species.
Josh Spiegel with us, wildlife biologist at the State Department of Natural Resources. You can be part of the discussion on elk. Call in with a question or share comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As elk breeding activity occurs in the fall and the elk hunt opens next month, we explore Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources efforts to try to help the elk herds thrive around the state with DNR wildlife biologist Josh Spiegel with us. And you can join the conversation. Call in with a question or comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mary in Menominee has a question. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to know how the wolf population is affecting the elk population.
Josh, what can you tell us?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Mary. Wolves are the number one predator that that elk do see in the state. But, you know, one of the main reasons for that is after about 3 months of age, a wolf is the only thing that can really take down an adult elk or an elk even past that time frame. So we do see other predation before that, you know, within the first few weeks. Usually we see bear. You know, there's potential for coyote, etc., through that. But once they move on, they're the only predator on the landscape. So they do have an impact, but they are a natural predator of elk throughout the U.S. So it's not specific to the state of Wisconsin. And the other thing with that is elk being a herd associated animal, you know, every group has a large set of eyes, ears, and noses out there looking across the landscape, et cetera. So we do see wolf predation on elk. It kind of ebbs and flows throughout the year. Most of the year, the elk have the high advantage. They're a big, strong animal, again, with all those sensory features on them. And they move long distances. You know, they can pick up and move 4, 5, 6 miles overnight with no problem at all. So we do see that. Usually the difficult time of year comes late winter when the snow kind of crusts. You can think of those elk legs kind of like pencils punching through the snow. That tends to be more difficult for them and kind of gives the advantage to wolves at that time. But otherwise, elk do very well across the landscape. They kind of settle in between wolf pack territories.
All right, Mary, thank you so much for the call. So we're learning that they're flexible with their habitat, they're agile. And when you say big, how big is an elk compared to moose and white-tailed deer?
Yeah, no, great question, Kate. So elk are going to be about 3 to 4 times the size of a large white-tailed deer. They, you know, a cow will range about 500 to 600 pounds, 500 to 650, somewhere in there. And then a bull elk is typically going to be somewhere about 700-800 pounds, maybe up to 900 pounds in size. So at the end of the day, they're going to be about 2/3 the size of an adult moose. And again, about 3 to 4 times the size of a white-tailed deer.
Wow. Well, let's turn to the elk hunting season that opens October 14th. And in May, the DNR awarded elk hunting licenses to 4 randomly selected hunters. And you had more than 21,000 people applying. Why schedule a hunt when the total number of elk is below targets?
So that's a very common question that we get. So with elk management and the opportunity to pursue a game animal, part of our management plan is to provide that recreation to hunters on the landscape. With elk not being at population goal, isn't a super big thing because elk are harem breeders. So one particular bull can breed many, many cows in a given year. And what that means is there tends to be a surplus of bulls on the landscape. So there's bulls out there that may never become a harem bull and do a majority of the breeding and pass their genes along. So allowing a hunt to occur also ensures genetic mixing. You know, you don't have the same bull breeding the same cows year after year after year. And that's very important as we've introduced new genetics into our population. So in 2015, 16, 17, and 19, elk were brought into the state of Wisconsin to establish the Black River group, the Jackson County herd, as well as supplement the Northern herd. So hunting also allows us to continue mixing those genetics, getting bigger and stronger animals.
Were you surprised by the number of applications, or is that pretty typical?
I think I'm kind of indifferent on them. So the very first year we opened the hunt in 2018, We had just shy of 40,000 applicants, you know, the very first year, kind of inaugural hunt. And then since then, it's floated right around 25,000 a year. When you think about recreation stance, you know, the king in the state of Wisconsin is whitetail deer hunting. And we have over 700,000 deer hunters that venture into the woods during the fall months to pursue deer any given year. So, you know, 25,000 people putting in for elk isn't really that much compared to a whitetail hunters, but it's a very large number of people in general across the state.
Oh, thanks for that perspective. As we talk about elk in Wisconsin, we have State DNR wildlife biologist Josh Spiegel fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mitch in Middleton. Mitch, hi.
Hey, Kate. Hey, Josh. Just wondering if CWD or chronic wasting disease is affecting the elk population in Wisconsin.
Is chronic wasting disease affecting elk, Josh?
Yeah, thanks, Mitch. So at this point in time, we have not had a positive test within our elk herd, the northern or the central herds here in the state of Wisconsin. But we continue to monitor where it is in the deer population. You know, that's something not only for local wildlife, but elk that we wanna maintain as well. And to ensure that, we test as many elk as we can throughout the year. So our CWD test that we do obviously comes from elk that have incurred some type of mortality. So it's mandatory for all of our elk hunters that harvest an elk that we pull that sample if we have vehicle collisions or a different mortality factor that animal could have a viable sample taken from. We take and test that animal for CWD, and it has not been found in elk in Wisconsin to this point.
In terms of those collisions, the breeding season upon us, and that could lead to more people traveling to where herds are located, hoping to see elk. What do drivers need to know about how to avoid hitting elk?
Yeah, first and foremost, again, how large they are. A lot of people that we kind of have communications with, they, you know, they're used to seeing white-tailed deer. You know, they dart across the roads, running back and forth, whatever they might do. And elk typically don't run. Usually if you see elk, they're just going to kind of lumber around. If cows have calves, the calf might dart around. But those adult animals, they're just going to kind of lumber around and walk. They know they're the biggest thing on the landscape. So they're not really too interested in expending different energy. So the best recommendation we have for people is keep your eyes open, you know, looking in on the roadway, obviously, but within the ditches, and just exercise caution in areas that we have elk. We made a big effort a couple of years back to do a bunch of roadway signing. So similar to the white-tailed deer crossings in the state, we have signs that say elk crossing area. And usually those are good areas people want to practice a little extra caution for elk. If you do have a passenger, it's not a bad idea to, you know, to have another set of eyes out looking and maybe the ditch etches, et cetera, like that. But typically speaking, we hope to avoid these issues by having better habitat away from the highways.
Do you have a most memorable encounter with an elk in Wisconsin that you can share?
I think I would probably say I have too many to even remember, but just being part of the Kentucky reintroduction effort and working with another state agency that has elk and the intricacies that kind of go with that as a whole is definitely a career highlight from my point of view.
You know, elk out west, they have migration patterns as they kind of follow food they want in the winter. Do our elk have any type of migration tendencies?
Not really. So here in the state of Wisconsin, within both ranges, we have what's called all-season habitat. So in the summertime, elk are going to forage primarily on grasses, forbs, lightly on kind of some woody browse. And that's going to be available throughout the entire growing season and even on the fringes. You know, as soon as snow goes out, they're going to be chewing on last year's grass, etc. When wintertime comes, they kind of transition to more browse. In the early snow, they'll still dig down to the grasses and eat there, but then they'll transition to woody browse. So the woody shoot ends, buds, etc. on tree branches. So they're gonna eat on that primarily over winter. And they have that ability within both ranges. Timber management is really big. So primary landowners across the ranges include like the U.S. Forest Service, Wisconsin DNR, local county forest governments. We have some tribal lands, etc. And all those folks actively practice proper silvicultural practices.
Josh, thank you for joining us.
No problem at all.
Josh Spiegel is a Hayward-based wildlife biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Planned Parenthood clinics in Madison and Milwaukee resume abortion services for patients, we examine this moment with Tanya Atkinson, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. And you can take part in the discussion. Call in with a question, share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tanya, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Abortion care now available at one of your clinics in Milwaukee, one in Madison. What is the demand for appointments like in the first week back?
Yeah, the demand is great. We opened appointments on Thursday, and the appointments were filled within 24 hours.
Has that intensity continued for your staff?
Yes, it has. It's clear that the need is there, and it's clear that, people in Wisconsin, absolutely need and deserve that care right in their own backyard.
What are the challenges of resuming abortion services after nearly 15 months?
Well, I think the biggest challenge was, getting the legal clarification that we needed, and we're thrilled when that finally came. When Roe was overturned, we Planned Parenthood Wisconsin did not contend that law automatically went into place, and at the same time, it was there was a lot of there's a lack of clarity, which would have a huge impact on people's lives, the providers who are caring for patients. And so so when that clarification finally came from the Dane County Circuit Court, we were able to move with some speed to get our operations back up and running, because we were incredibly fortunate that all of our staff stayed with the organization and were ready to go.
So I'm wondering, and we're going to get to the ruling or to the judge's opinion in a moment, but, especially for patients who did travel out of state for abortions, are you communicating with your patients about the new change to your services that they can receive care here in Wisconsin once again?
Yes, absolutely. We're communicating with people in, as many ways as we possibly can, from media to online communications to call center. So we're really getting those communications out there as much as we possibly can.
Why start with clinics in Madison and Milwaukee?
Excellent question. So prior to Roe falling, of 72 counties, Wisconsin only had 3 counties with abortion providers. Planned Parenthood Wisconsin had centers in the 2 centers that are open in Madison and Milwaukee. There was another independent provider in Milwaukee. And then Planned Parenthood Wisconsin also had at our Sheboygan Center provided medication abortion only. So we resumed care in 2 of the 3 centers where we were providing abortion care, and are logistically trying to work our way toward reopening again for medication abortion in Sheboygan. The Sheboygan Health Center is open and has been providing the rest of the scope of services, and looking at how we can logistically resume providing medication abortion in Sheboygan.
So looking at the from your perspective of the judge's Dane County Circuit judge's opinion, And as you reopen, the judge saying the 1849 ban only applying to non-consensual feticide. So why base your decision on that?
Well, because the judge made it clear that it did not apply to voluntary abortion, which is the services that we were providing. And, you know, when Roe was overturned, you know, we knew we had two paths forward in order to restore care as soon as we possibly could. One was a legislative path, which isn't available right now, and the other was a legal path. So as soon as that clarification came from the court, we immediately began working with legal experts, physicians, stakeholders, and are incredibly confident in our decision to resume care because the judge could not have been more clear in her opinions.
What is considered a consensual abortion under Wisconsin law?
Well, I think in the ruling, it's the contrast. So, you know, the care that Planned Parenthood provides, that other healthcare providers, you know, provide with regard to abortion care, you know, that's the termination of a pregnancy. And then, you know, with feticide, as you stated in the opening, that is, for example, in the case that made its way to the Supreme Court, was an act of severe battery where somebody battered his partner who was, near giving birth, and that baby died.
So assaulting, battering the mother. Okay, feticide definition there, and the judge pointing that out in that July ruling. So, you know, what is your plan for abortion services in the future if court opinions rule in favor of the 1849 ban?
Well, if the courts do rule in favor of the 1849 ban, then very unfortunately, we would have to suspend abortion services again.
We're talking about Planned Parenthood resuming abortion services in Wisconsin this week with the organization's leader, Tanya Atkinson. You can join in with your questions and what you would like to share. The number to join in the conversation is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tanya, rewinding to June last year, the U.S. Supreme Court eliminating the national legal right to abortions. How is the uncertainty over abortion care affecting women's health?
Well, the information, the research is coming out across the country. This is having a devastating impact on women's health across the country, women's safety across the country, people across the gender spectrum who need an abortion across the entire country. We know that, for example, Planned Parenthood Wisconsin had abortion navigators that could help people, you know, get to other states, you know, possibly remove some resource barriers. At the same time, you know, the need to travel is insurmountable for some people for a lot of different reasons. And certainly we've heard stories from Wisconsin and from other states where people are asked to travel out of state for, in conditions that they probably shouldn't be traveling in, like ectopic pregnancies. So this is, it's devastating and it's dangerous.
Can you help us walk in the shoes of Planned Parenthood navigators, what they were doing and assisting and what it is like now?
Yes. So the navigators are still, doing their work. Certainly the landscape across the country has changed. Prior to Roe falling, it was still very difficult to access abortion in the state of Wisconsin. And so Planned Parenthood Wisconsin already had a network of support, financial support, other resources for people who needed to travel great distances. With the Navigator program, people could make an appointment directly, and they could then, work with the Navigator to understand what the needs were, where was it best for people to travel, did they need overnight lodging, did they need transportation, and the Navigators could, book the transportation directly. So, a lot of Wisconsinites that access care that we're aware of went to Illinois, and if somebody had a resource or support system in New York or California, the Navigators could help with that. I think the biggest thing the Navigators saw and the question they got was regarding the expenses of needing to travel out of state.
What would those expenses be like? How much?
Well, it would, you know, depend on the individual.
Sure.
So, you know, beginning with childcare costs to lost wages, the transportation, if you have your own vehicle or if you need to, you know, have some other kind of transportation made available, depending on your situation, do you need to stay overnight in another state? You know, so the expenses, and then the procedure itself, of course, mm-hmm. the healthcare services itself. So those expenses can, you know, really add it up very quickly for people.
I wonder, over the past 15 months, how has your relationship with out-of-state Planned Parenthood clinics, how has that changed?
Well, we definitely have, you know, much closer working relationships. We worked very closely with our friends at Planned Parenthood of Illinois, and our team members who are providing abortion in Wisconsin drove to Illinois throughout the week to expand access to care because so many people from across the country were going to Illinois, including Wisconsin patients. So when the leak happened and we saw that Roe was going to fall, we began developing that infrastructure with Planned Parenthood of Illinois. And our navigators and others, of course, would refer to any abortion provider, not just Planned Parenthood of Illinois. But we developed an infrastructure together. And on one day a week, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin solely ran one of the health centers in Illinois.
It sounds like you have created new systems, new processes in order to continue to serve in your fullest capacity.
Yes, that's correct. There are new systems and processes, you know, both for Wisconsin and, you know, and across the country. And at the same time, you know, it's critical that people have access to abortion, and they have access to abortion as near to their home as possible.
Tanya Atkinson is CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. You can join the discussion at any point, calling in with a question, adding your insights, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the legal and the political landscape in Wisconsin as Planned Parenthood resumes offering abortions at two clinics, Madison and Milwaukee, after nearly 15 months since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Call in with a question or share your thoughts at any point in the conversation. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Tanya Atkinson with us, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Tanya, as you bring back abortion care at your clinics, how prepared are your staffing levels, or did they never change?
That's an excellent question. Our staffing levels didn't change. We were incredibly grateful that the team stayed with us, and you know, a number of them traveled to Illinois, providing care in Illinois, and they do share that when a Wisconsin patient would hear that they had Wisconsin providers in Illinois, the patients would share there was a level of comfort in that, knowing that they were kind of in it together, as it were. So some were traveling to Illinois, and others were providing other services. In Milwaukee, we expanded services, including vasectomy services, as well as adding additional cancer prevention and intervention services through colposcopies and LEAPS. So the team stayed intact and were ready to resume the minute we were able to do that.
We saw on the federal level, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin introduced the Reproductive Health Care Training Act in June. Are you concerned about the pipeline of trained abortion providers in Wisconsin?
Well, that's an excellent question. When Roe was overturned, immediately the medical colleges across the state were sharing that people who were slated to come to Wisconsin didn't, were questioning whether or not they should come to Wisconsin. you know, our physicians have shared that they know of people who decided not to come to Wisconsin, people who were already in Wisconsin questioning whether or not they should stay, both for their education, and often these are young people of reproductive age themselves, and understanding how dangerous it is, you know, to be pregnant in a state where you can't access abortion care.
Since last year, the Federal Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, it's filed at least 10 criminal cases of violent action toward reproductive health care providers. Is opposition to abortion services affecting the mental health of your staff?
So that's an excellent question. And, you know, the health and the safety and the security of our patients and our staff is always our number one priority. And, you know, this is a service that they believe in very strongly, that they are incredibly committed to, and at the same time, you know, certainly the harassment that happens out in the environment, the political environment, you know, can be tiring, and so we ensure as an organization that we do everything possible to make sure that they have the supports in place, so that they can, you know, so that they can take care of themselves while they're taking care of others.
We've heard from Nancy from Milwaukee, called in to discuss birth control. And Nancy thinks that abortion appointments filling up within 24 hours is an indication that people need to take birth control more seriously. What is your reaction to that?
So birth control is very important. And the reasons that people need an abortion are as numerable as the number of people that need an abortion. You know, abortion is not birth control, and you know, and again, the reason people need abortions, the you know, range widely. So I agree that if people want to contracept, they should have access to that. And we do have 22 health centers across the state. All of them provide access to contraception for people. So definitely agree with that. And at the same time, because there was such a need, you know, does not necessarily indicate that people are using abortion for birth control. It indicates that people needed abortion access in their backyard.
Do you think is abortion politics affecting the mental health of your patients?
You know, I can't speak to the mental health of the patients. I can say that when Roe was overturned, you know, we had you know, people in our waiting rooms. And our staff had to go out when we were, you know, given the instruction to stop providing care. Staff had to go out and, you know, tell people that, you know, that decision that they just made for themselves, somebody else just made that for them, and they weren't able to, you know, provide care for them that day and work to find appointments elsewhere. And know that some of those patients, it was devastating. For some patients, it was, you know, hard to believe. Some patients showed up anyway, even after having conversations about not being able to access care in Wisconsin, because it was so unbelievable that their state, you know, I'm from Wisconsin, Wisconsinites often love Wisconsin, right? Mm-hmm. That their state of Wisconsin would let this happen to them.
What was that June day like for you personally?
Well, I mean, I think about, you know, for us across the organization, it was terrible. It was terrible to know that there were people, you know, both on that day and then the days that follow, appointments were already scheduled. You know, all those people that needed access to that care were not able to get it, and how, you know, it's really hard to put into words how you know, incredibly, I mean, it's, I keep saying devastating because I think that's the best word. I mean, you know, it's challenging. It's been challenging to access abortion in Wisconsin to begin with. And then to have this, you know, additional, you know, incredible barrier, you know, it's hard to know that people are being harmed when, you know, when your organization's role is to help people.
We're talking about Planned Parenthood resuming abortion services in Wisconsin with the organization's leader, Tanya Atkinson, is here. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Bill in Southwest Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. Bill, can you hear us? Oh, I think we're having some difficulty hearing Bill. And I think one Bill wanted to address the court ruling and could a lawyer make the case for infanticide and the difference there between infanticide and feticide. Could you address that, Tanya?
Well, I am not a lawyer, so I'm sure there's a lot of different ways that that lawyers could argue that question. What is clear to us is that, you know, Planned Parenthood Wisconsin provides voluntary abortions, and the judge has made it clear that that law doesn't apply to voluntary abortions.
You mentioned earlier that you're looking at the path through courts and that the legislative path is not possible now. As you look to the courts and you see the new Supreme Court makeup of a liberal majority, what impact does that have on the decisions you make going forward as an organization?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So our decision to resume was squarely a healthcare decision. And we knew at the time, you know, and I'm sure most of your listeners know that there are a lot of machinations right now happening between the legislature and the Supreme Court, and whether or not there's going to be an impeachment. And, you know, there's a lot happening there. And so, you know, that is an unknown to us. And, you know, our commitment was to resuming care as soon as we possibly could. We found that legal path forward and were able to resume care. Certainly we're paying attention to what's happening at the Supreme Court and what's happening between, you know, and what's happening at the legislature. But there was no reason for us to delay the care, and we can't make our healthcare decisions based on what's happening with Wisconsin politics.
And you say Planned Parenthood will never back down until abortion access is protected and expanded for patients. In our last minute together, what are your next plans for expanding abortion care?
Yes, thank you. We do consider this a first step, resuming access. Wisconsin has got some of the longest list of unnecessary, politically motivated abortion restrictions of any state in the entire country. And so it's critical that even though, you know, abortion was available in Wisconsin, it often wasn't accessible to people. So those unnecessary restrictions, we have to look at how do we get, you know, get rid of those, and then continue to move forward long term. How does not just abortion, but reproductive health care, you know, the full scope of reproductive health care, how is that depoliticized and instead, you know, supported and becomes a you know, an expected public health investment?
Mm. And what about funding stability in our last moments here together? Do you have the funding to be able to break down those barriers?
Well, we, you know, we continue to move forward. We've got, you know, certainly this is a priority investment for us. Mm. And so, we're, you know, looking at ensuring that we do prioritize our resources so that we can move those forward. And certainly we have supporters, you know, and at the same time, you know, it's a big investment, and it's a priority investment for us. So we are going to do everything in our power to make sure that we can continue moving that long-term goal forward.
Tanya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. Appreciate you.
Tanya Atkinson is president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.